The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
We've got our panel in and lots on the show, lots to talk about. John Lee is executive editor of the Daily Mail Group. We've got Sheila Nocton, who is a News Talk reporter. And we've got Conor Pope, consumer affairs correspondent with the Irish Times. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
Did you catch the very, very exciting Olympic relay final last night?
Yes. Been glued to the Olympics. Absolutely love it. I don't know what I'm going to do when it's over. But I was heartbroken for them. I don't know, did you watch the interview after?
Well, they were playing down the expectations going into it. Certainly the commentary team on television were going, look, anything better than sixth would be incredible. But then as when you saw Rashida just accelerate like a laser beam.
Put us into second position, yeah. Like in silver medal position. So I think I can imagine the heartbreak for them. But as someone watching, I felt so proud of them. And I think then when you see these women who have worked so hard and are such incredible role models crying because they feel they've let either themselves or other people. I was nearly in tears myself watching Charlene Maudsley on her birthday say, I feel like it's my fault. I was so upset for them, but I was so proud.
I know, and we all should be so proud. And it was interesting that yesterday on the show, I was talking about my innate fear of having anything to do with a baton exchange or having to run with one without dropping it. And then you see the poor Jamaicans, maybe one of them got a nudge, possibly from Rashida along the way. But she dropped the baton and you just thought, oh my God. And you saw them all crying then on the finish line. It must be devastating, John.
Sport's tough.
Yeah.
Sport's tough. Fourth, you get no medal, but you know, am I right? I've been all over the place on my watching of the Olympics for various reasons, but it's by long shot our best ever. So, you know, it's been an incredible boost for athletics and other sports as they go seeking their funding in the giveaway few months we have ahead of us.
Well, that's the big thing, isn't it? If we put our money where our mouth is now and don't expect people to run around running tracks that are closed off, you know, and all the other poor facilities that we have to deal with in this country. Hopefully there'll be an improvement. Well, look, the Olympics closing ceremony takes place at 8 p.m. Irish time tonight in the Stade de France. The closing ceremony in Tokyo lasted for about 3 hours, so we could be in for another epic treat. And of course, there was that heroic effort to chase the bronze medal by the Irish quartet as the US won gold quite convincingly last night. Well, our man, Ger Gilroy from Off the Ball, has been following all the action in Paris over the last few weeks. How are you feeling after it, Ger?
Yeah. You know, that whole bit about what are we going to do when it finishes? This whole city has had their TVs on and blaring and big screens in every arrondissement, where there's been like proper organized collective watching. So it's not just been the fact that there's world-class events on in these amazing arenas dotted all over the city. Everybody has tuned in over the last 2.5 weeks and they're going to have the biggest hangover in world history. What the hell are they going to do at the time?
Yeah, well, we've still got the big party tonight to deal with. And I don't know, is it part of your sporting requirement to go to the closing ceremony? But the fact that a certain Mr. Tom Cruise is expected to perform some class of a stunt, I'm not sure if it'll be live or actually a pre-recorded one. I suspect the latter. But surely you'd have to go along and see if Tom Cruise is going to provide any entertainment.
I don't know if you've been to the Stade de France recently, but as you walk up to the Stade de France, there is this absolutely glistening, giant Scientology building where they're blaring music and offering free tea and coffee. And it's not without controversy that Tom Cruise has been linked with. So we don't know what's going to happen tonight, but his name has been leaked and linked over the course of the last 10 days or so. And he was at the gymnastics watching Simone Biles alongside the head of Discovery, the channel that basically owns the rights in the States. And I mean, I didn't realize this, but doing some reading on it today, Scientology is not considered a religion in France. It's considered a cult. L. Ron Hubbard was convicted in his absence for fraud, and a couple of other people were convicted a decade ago. So it would be kind of a big deal if he was to be involved tonight. But, you know, the French do like to also, they love their rogues, and maybe he fits into that category.
Were you tempted at all to follow the lure of muffins and free tea and just pop into the Scientology building just to have a good nose around?
Very tempted. Very tempted. And, you know, the day is young. It could still happen. just working up the courage.
Yeah, well, we did hear that the closing ceremony maybe has had a few tweaks in light of the controversy around the opening ceremony, and maybe any slightly controversial elements might have been whipped out of there last minute.
We'll see. We'll see, because again, that's very non-French, right? However, perhaps the IOC are like, look, we're going to conservative America and we kind of need them on board. So if there's anything that is going to annoy them, then maybe you want to have a second look at it. But equally, they are French, so they might just go, no, screw you, we're going to do this. Because that was one of the best parts about the opening ceremony, was its diversity, was the fact that it was reflective of a modern world and that it was entirely unconcerned with the manufactured war that's going on, the culture wars that are going on. And that continued right through with Imani Khalif. The British media, certain elements of the British media, lost their minds about a story that had been like perfectly present for the last 8 years, as Imani Khalif has been a boxer. But their conduct was, that's definitely one of the lowlights for me over the course of the last 2.5 weeks. So I hope the French organisers, and it's the same artistic director who did the opening, I hope he says, yeah, definitely, we'll definitely do that. And then rubs their noses in it.
Mm. I did like one of Eamon Sweeney's lines in The Independent today, in the Sunday Indo, on page 8. And he was talking about, you know, the Irish performances and the people who represented us in green. And it showed that, as he says, there's no one way of being Irish. And I think that's what's so glaringly obvious, you know, the benefits of what we've been witnessing in light of what's happening in other parts of our society at the moment. It's never been as important to highlight there is no one way of being Irish. When you look at the heritage of a lot of people in green, that, you know, this is Ireland, this is who we are now, and this is what we can achieve.
Sport is entirely a meritocracy, notwithstanding some people don't get to where they should do because of political interference. But on merit, if you run the fastest, jump the highest, if you can row the fastest or whatever sport you're in, you're going to get there, because it's a black and white outcome. If you can hit the hardest. And I think a point you made earlier on about the facilities, there is a press conference this morning where Neil Martin and the sports minister are going to outline some funding plans. I really hope it's not exactly what happened the last time when, I don't know if you remember, Shane Ross kind of basically winning the Hockey World Cup or whatever it was he was doing at that stage and doing all the, and telling everyone, oh, I've got €1 million for you. But it was just old money. It was just the money that the government had already committed. What we need off the back of this is a commitment to investment in grassroots sport and elite sport. And it's a dual process where you get the kids who are inspired by the elite athletes, but you also allow the elite athletes continue to prosper and do better and have more strength and depth, so that, you know, we get another 400 meter runner who's fast enough to get us on the podium next.
Mm. It was lovely to watch the Olympics last night with my 13-year-old daughter, who was giving out because she wanted to play her PlayStation. And I was like, no, we're watching this. And she was really drawn in by the athletes themselves. I mean, they look so fit, they look so strong, and they look glamorous to her. I mean, she's 13, she's all about makeup at the moment. But so these incredible athletes, and it also looked like a genetic Olympics with all the male and female athletes. It really looked like, wow, the human race is in great shape. The improvements in nutrition and fitness and science really is, you know, paying off. And it was really important for me, for my daughter, to watch those incredible athletes last night.
Yeah, I think Charlene Mosley, she was the cover star of the Sunday Indo magazine last week. And she made the point that, you know, look good, run fast. And it gives her confidence. And I think one of the other things that's really noticeable is that there was a real fear that athletics and these Olympic sports, which are the, you know, not football, rugby and GAA in Ireland in particular, would be swamped and kind of disappear a bit. But what's happened is many of the individuals have become brilliant on social media. So Charlene Mosley has a massive following. There's a bunch of others, the rowers, some of the rugby players. And these sports are also perfect if you have a short attention span, because the race is over really quickly. So you don't have to sit down for 90 minutes, watch the football, watch half an hour of analysis either side of it. There's generally three things happening at once. Like, there'll be pole vault going in one corner, there'll be triple jump over the other side, and then there'll be a 5,000 meter race. So you can tune in and tune out, and you can catch highlights of these beautiful genetic freaks, as you're talking about, doing great stuff. And I kind of feel like, you know, talking to some people who are veterans of it, that they feel like the Olympics is having a moment and is coming back to a position where it really matters. Because when we were kids, it was the be-all and end-all. Like, one of the first things you would learn about would be the 4 gold medals and the Berlin Olympics and how Jesse Owens had put it up to Hitler. But those stories, like, you know, no one cares about those anymore because we're overwhelmed by transfer gossip and Premier League glitz and glam and the scandal of VAR. But actually, I do feel like TV companies have kind of got their coverage, certainly the big American ones. And here in France, they've got their coverage spot on. There's been less jabber-jabber and far more action being shown. I'm not sure if that's the case back at home in Ireland. I think there's been some criticism of the coverage there. And it feels like the Olympic sports are becoming more accessible to audiences like your 13-year-old, who now, I presume, is on social media and started following these athletes. And hopefully will tune in knowing a good bit more about them and tuning into all the information that they're happy to share.
Mm. Read an interesting statistic this morning that in 100 years, Ireland had won medals in only 6 sports. And in Paris this year alone, we won 4 golds in 4 different sports. The diversity of, you know, what we can achieve now across all sports, that's very impressive and really was highlighted this year, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I think, look, this is a boring answer to this is that we've got our policy largely correct. Most of the infighting in Irish sports has been consigned to the dustbin of history. Like, I don't know if everybody remembers or has the stomach to go back to, the Sports Council will be at loggerheads with the Olympic Federation as it used to be during the Pat Hickey era, for example. And the individual sports themselves would be tearing themselves apart because the people up in Dublin were getting more than the people in Munster, and the people in Munster were getting more than the people in Connacht. You're like, oh my God, everybody, can we not just like get the fastest runners, the best coaches? And over the last 20 years, it's been a concerted effort to improve coaching and improve structures. And you'd have to say Sports Campus Ireland out in Abbotstown has been a kind of key driver in that, because the best high performers are bumping up against each other, comparing and contrasting, sharing knowledge. And that's happening at an athlete level, and it's happening at a coaching level, and it's happening at an administration level. And so it turns out if you put a bit of money in, you get great returns out. So that's the case for making better investment, that we've shown that we can provide value for money, inspire and unite the country. And then you need that follow-up where there are an army of volunteers and grassroots facilities being opened so that kids in the inner city can play basketball late at night. You know, there's a million different ways that you can take advantage of what we've seen. And you're right, the diversity of the sports, we have really good talent. The talent ID programs are now working properly. And we're beginning to get there. But like, look, this could just be a flame out on the back of 3 or 4 great individuals if we don't make sure that we build on it.
Mm. In terms of watching the sports and your own personal experience as a sports fan at the Olympics, I mean, I love golf, but I think it's a terrible sport to actually, you know, watch as a spectator on the ground. You're much better off watching it on telly because you just miss so much. What have the events that you've seen been like as a spectator to watch? Because the Olympics are so entertaining on TV when you're jumping from event to event. What's it like to actually be there?
In many ways, I'd say the swimming is probably a great example of that too, because you're literally at the end of the race. When they touch the wall, a red light goes off for the first 3, and it's like a long red light for the first, a shorter one, and maybe it's the other way around. But you're actually watching up the TV, see what happens, looking up the big screen. But it's the atmosphere, I think, is the thing that makes it worth being there. Because, you know, so Léon Marchand, the French swimmer, who was the hero of the first week, and funnily enough, he arrived at the basketball last week. LeBron thought everybody was cheering for him because he was on the big screen and didn't actually realize that, the biggest man in French sport at the moment literally just walked into the arena and the crowd went wild. But look, the other thing I would say, rowing was a brilliant, brilliant experience, because basically all of Skibbereen, who you didn't see on your social media, were at the rowing, and that created this incredible atmosphere. But again, you're kind of just waiting for the rowers to pass you by. And then the other things, like the basketball is way better being there. Like they are the greatest collection of talent that there's ever been playing together and going behind in matches that they really want to win at the very end of their career. So But that's the other side of it. And then the other one was the tennis, being there for Nadal against Djokovic. Rafa Nadal hits the ball so hard in a way that you cannot feel on the TV. Like, they amp up the noise, but to actually watch the ping of the explosive forehand at Roland Garros,
that's really interesting, actually, because I think it is something that you pick up on when you see a professional golfer hit a drive. Their golf club makes a different sound. I remember seeing Rory hit, I thought it sounded like a gunshot, you know, and it's something, as you say, that doesn't come across on TV. Well, look, we wish you the best with the closing ceremony tonight. I think it's probably fitting that there is a Los Angeles connection in Tom Cruise, because that's where the next Olympics is. So it does make sense that he's there, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point of it. Yeah, I think traditionally you would hand this on with some kind of cliched reference to what's coming next. But your man, the organizer, or the creative director, doesn't really seem to do that much cliché. We'll see.
Jared, thanks for all the great coverage to you and your team over the last while. Enjoy tonight. Safe home. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, Dermot. Take care.
It's Dermot Whelan in for Anton Savage this weekend on the Anton Savage Show. Text is 53106 to reach us here at News Talk. Text will cost you 30 cent. And the WhatsApp is 087-1400-106. I'm here with my Sunday panel, John Lee, Executive Editor of Daily Mail Group, Sheila Nocton, News Talk reporter, and Connor Pope, Consumer Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Times. Let's dive into the papers, shall we? Because on the front of the Independent and inside on page 6, the Taoiseach goes to war against online hatred. And this was a fairly impressive stance from Taoiseach Simon Harris on taking on the likes of Meta and X, formerly Twitter. And you have to say, John, that, you know, with all the goodwill in the world, and you can see where he's coming from, because indeed he does have a personal involvement in this, and the fact that, you know, he's been receiving death threats and bomb threats on social media himself, though he's personally invested in this. But you'd have to say that his work is cut out for him.
I wouldn't carry the cynicism a lot of people do when it comes to this. You know, it was, that is, social media was the Wild West until very recently. We have legislation, recent legislation with the, and I'll read it because there is the Digital Services Act, which then from the EU, which imposes huge fines on social media companies. And again, people can be cynical about the amount of money that they earn that make them not care. Commercial enterprises only care about fines. So that has now been opened up with legislation here, which allows the government to allow the courts to move on social media companies and impose fines. The concern in government right now is, what I write about today in our paper, is the lack of speed with which the justice system is moving against miscreants online in comparison to other jurisdictions. And if we saw last week in Britain, there were threats made, there were incitements to rioting made through social media outlets. And people are now, as we speak, in jail, sleeping in jails over their activity online within the last week. That is something that concerns the government and the Gardaí that is not happening here. They want to know, they want to investigate where that holdup is. Is it the courts themselves? Is the DPP failing to move with requisite speed? This is a question they're asking. I'm not saying it's the answer, with requisite speed from the Gardaí. They're actually happy with how the Gardaí have moved on some of these people in the last while. Simon Harris is a modern politician. He, more so than anyone, and I don't say this with a smile on my face, is aware of the power of social media. And he has now suffered, he and his family, in recent weeks, to some vile from some vile threats made online. And I would point out, it's a cross party concern. Mary Lou MacDonald felt it was required of her to report threats that were made to her online recently to the Gardaí, which she did. And we have seen a heightened level of activity when it comes to threats on social media to politicians, which have then manifested themselves in actual physical threats. So,
but isn't one of the issues, Connor, that, you know, even Commissioner Mann freely admit that it doesn't have the power to compel companies such as Facebook or X to remove illegal content? it still relies on them to self-police. And even the Taoiseach's, our own leader's death threats didn't come down in a time that was anyway acceptable.
Yeah, I think it took 48 hours for Instagram to respond and take down the death threats, which is just absurd. And when you hear about self-policing in big tech, it's never a good sign. And the reality is that I wouldn't consider myself a cynic, but I would certainly be a lot more cynical than John when it comes to whether or not the Taoiseach's war on online threats is going to have any kind of success whatsoever. Because I can't think of a single example of any jurisdiction anywhere in the world that has successfully challenged the problems that have beset online platforms such as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, ever. So the idea that we in Ireland would launch this kind of war against this kind of toxicity and win just seems absurd. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't be tilting at windmills and we shouldn't be trying to at least challenge these people, because it's only by having those conversations and it's only by holding them to account repeatedly that some kind of change might come about. But I would be wildly pessimistic that anything will come of this. And the reality is, like, I mean, I'll recall about 2 years ago, some clown on Instagram posted a message to me and he said, "I'm going to get you." And he knew where I lived. So he had the street that I lived on. So, like, I wasn't overly concerned. But having said that, some guy is threatening to do me harm and knows where I live. So I went down to my local Garda station and I said, "Just want to show you this, just so that it's on the record." Like, I'm not expecting you to get the crack team on it, you know, but like, just so you
know, it's a legitimate threat.
This has happened. Yeah. And the guy was, yeah, that's terrible. I said, like, you know, any chance you could find out who it was? Like, there's a digital footprint to this guy. Like, I mean, I'd say he wasn't exactly a criminal mastermind. So, I mean, like, they would have been able to find him in 20 minutes in Instagram. He said, there's no point in us contacting Instagram because they're not going to do anything. And that's the reality. Now, I'm a tiny little fish. So if they took 48 hours for the Taoiseach, like, you know, what hope do we have? And the reality is that these big tech firms profit from hate. They profit from this kind of toxic communication. So they're not going to stop while they're making money because they can take the fines. The Irish government could fine them 10 million, 20 million, 50 million. Not going to make a blind bit of difference to what they do. And that, unfortunately, is the reality.
Well, you're up against the likes of Elon Musk, who is a self-declared freedom of speech absolutist, as he calls himself. So it is a big task. And in a way, it kind of reminds me, Sheila, maybe of the challenge of getting phones, out of national schools. You know, if you're one parent and you don't want your under 12 to have a phone, you're kind of fighting a losing battle. But if every parent comes together, then you can start to change the narrative. You can change the landscape of the phone in school. And in a way, you feel like Simon Harris, if he will need the backing of other countries, of other governments. And it's not until it's at least, you know, at a pan-European level that we're actually going to see some movement.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm probably more, Conor, I'm probably a bit cynical as well. Like, I think that, you know, I think back in maybe April, was it 1% or 2% of those fines were paid? I mean, what incentive do they have to suddenly cooperate now? We also saw Norma Foley a few months ago. She tried to get them to bring in something so simple as just getting age verification done properly on social media for children. And their answer was effectively, meh. Like that, she was like, "Oh well, they didn't give a commitment, but so they said no." So if they won't even just try and protect children, the most vulnerable online, I mean, we've had awful cases where we've literally seen murders live streamed in Ireland, and that is put on WhatsApp. Once it's online, it can be put on anywhere, and you can take it off the social media after 48 hours, but it's still out there. So I kind of don't really know what hope there is to be able to suddenly take them on now again as just Ireland on its own. And similarly to Conor there, I've had instances of threats online, and I had someone's video of them talking about me on TikTok, and I brought that forward and was told, well, you're not in physical danger. So I suppose there's a helplessness there as well.
I'm surprised this sunny day everyone's so pessimistic. You know, history has shown that corporations have gotten out of hand. Maybe the Irish government are not the ones to take them on, but certainly when the mice of the US state becomes involved in this, as it is, and we've seen, for instance, their actions against TikTok, I wouldn't be so pessimistic that corporations of this size can't be taken on in the world, and somehow they're going to take over the world in the fashion that some of my colleagues here have said they will. Standard Oil 100 years ago had to be broken up. I think I'm just being a little more optimistic about it. When the might of sovereign states takes on corporations, the sovereign state wins. And similarly here, we've had an arrest in the last week over threats made to the Taoiseach. A bomb threat made online. There are hopes that another arrest will be made. The system is catching up, but it will catch up.
Mm. I have to say, when I read what Simon Harris was saying, I was reading it on a news outlet on my phone, and I kind of felt a burst of pride, and was like, but you know what? It's great that he is saying these things. And if you are wondering what he said, my concern isn't with Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg. He said, my concern is the protection, safety and well-being of people in this country, of the European Union, of which we're a member, and of the young people whose parents are deeply anxious about the impact that online and social media have on their children's well-being. Quite frankly, not enough is being done in this space by anybody, anywhere.
No, he's absolutely right to say that. There's no doubt about that. And it is entirely commendable that he says it. But whether or not it will achieve anything is the question. Now, I think it's interesting that John mentioned Standard Oil, which was broken up 100 years ago. And as we all know, the oil industry has done no harm to the planet over the last 100 years. So they sorted out Standard Oil and everything was fine after that. And they went after TikTok, I think you'll probably agree, not so much because they were concerned about the pernicious algorithms or what the companies were doing to the minds of young individuals. They went after TikTok for an entirely different reason. And the reality is, you say, oh, we shouldn't be so pessimistic. We have never been here before. We're carrying out this huge social experiment on the minds of everybody on the planet. And we're all just going, oh, well, there's nothing much we can do, or it'll be grand. It won't be grand unless there's a global force targeting these people. And that's the reality. Mm.
Big story on the front of the Sunday Times today. More than 1,000 teaching positions remain vacant in primary and secondary schools across Ireland before the new school year. 1,000 teaching positions. That's huge, Sheila.
Yeah, I don't think this is a new story. We've been reporting on the amount of vacancies for a long time. So it's 557 primary and 460 secondary. And I suppose one of the big issues here is, so how do they make that up? And a lot of the commentary in that article is that it's going to come from places like special education or teachers who are maybe not fully qualified, a lot of subs standing in. So that was going to lead to things like less stability within schools. When it comes to special education, I know my mother was a resource teacher for a long time. Those children really need that outlet. You can't have teachers being taken away from that. That means that certain vulnerable children are maybe going to be further held back if that goes. And then you also have limited subjects and options in secondary school. So for example, I specifically went to the secondary school I went to because it had more options, because I knew I wasn't good at science and maths. Mm-hmm. And had I gone to the one near my area, I might have been forced to do those because it was such a small school. So it's about getting the best opportunity then to get to college or wherever you want to progress to. And that could all be limited by this. But it all comes back to issues within kind of, you know, if a teacher goes abroad and they work there, their experience doesn't carry over to when they come back to Ireland. So they don't come in on the incremental scale where they should. And similarly as well, when it comes to career breaks. So I have a friend at the moment who did leave the country and who would have come back after a year had they been given a career break, but they weren't. So now they're not coming back to teaching because they haven't been given the career break.
Recognising that legitimate work experience, teaching experience outside the EU seems to be a no-brainer in terms of trying to address this. But as usual, we have a tendency just to fling money at things and hope it works. And it actually hasn't worked, because there was the incentive of giving €2,000 to newly qualified teachers to take up a full-time role. And that clearly hasn't worked, because they're going, €2,000 is not going to help me live in Dublin. Sorry.
Yeah, leave Dublin, Cork and Limerick, three of the places that are most expensive and where they're struggling to get teachers. Because you've €2,000 this year. What do I do when my rent is the same and I've spent, what am I supposed to spread the 2,000 over all of the years of my teaching or until my salary increases to the point that I can survive on that salary? That's not going to happen. So no, it's not the incentive I think that they think it was going to be. And there was suggestions they should bring in something like for teachers who are in Dublin, they get kind of an ongoing supplementary payment, but that's been poo-pooed a lot.
Yeah. John, what would you like to see done to try and address this? Or is it, I noticed that what the Department of Education came back and said, that they had 3,700 newly qualified teachers registered last year with the Teaching Council, and that the rate of resignation and retirement was consistent with previous years. So they're kind of saying, well, it's not getting better, but it's not really getting any worse.
Yeah, there seems to be an inbuilt acceptance in the system that they're going to be about 1,000 down every year. As Sheila says, it may not be a particularly new story, but it is a reminder as the school year returns that that there's a huge problem. You know, my young son is in the Gael school. They've had issues getting teachers, which I think is a little more concentrated because there's a certain expertise there involved. But certainly the talk in our area has been that a lot of it is to do with housing. There seems to be an acceptance that somehow housing has diminished as a national issue in the last few months. And that's just looking at coverage and polling, which has brought cost of living into a higher concern. But then again, that is the issue that would row into housing. So that's going to be a long loop to get that solved. The teachers can afford to live in the areas where they want to teach and which most suffers. And not to now join the pessimistic group, but it seems like something they can't solve quickly. And that'll mean that a lot of sticking plaster is going to be put in the educational system for the next 4 or 5 years to plug those gaps, while hopefully housing catches up and allows teachers a standard of living that would allow them to live in those areas that are most suffering from reduced numbers of teachers.
Yeah, we're getting texts in at 53106 at a cost of 30 cent into News Talk. Maybe it's time for a mass boycott of social media, says Nora. Can't we live without TikTok, Insta, etc.? We're feeding the monster. A mass boycott is going to be a tricky one. I mean, a lot of us can't put down our phones for more than 5 minutes, and that's the nature of them. They're designed by, you know, the people who work for casinos, so they know what they're doing. There was an interesting thing, Connor, in the paper today by Luke O'Neill talking about a Mars experiment where trainee astronauts are living in isolation for 378 days, obviously no phones, limited contact, just to see the effects on them. Do you think you could live yourself for 378 days without a phone or technical contact?
I know for a fact that I couldn't, because I've tried on 2 separate occasions and I failed miserably. Once I wrote a piece about a digital detox, and there was a book that some guy had written, and he wrote the book and he was inspired. I can't for the life of me remember the name of the author, but he was inspired to write the book because he was in a cage watching sharks, and he was just having this amazing experience watching sharks underwater. And his instinct wasn't to go, this is just the most amazing thing. His instinct was to try and reach for his phone so he could take a photograph of the sharks. And of course he realised he didn't have his phone because he was under the water.
Yeah.
But he said he realised then that he had a problem, that rather than enjoying this experience, he wanted to document the experience on his phone. And it kind of resonated with me, and I said, you know what, I'll do a digital detox. And I'll only do it for a week. And after about, I'm not going to lie, 16 hours, I was like, I'll just have a quick look. Nobody will know. And then at the end of the second day, I was back of all in on my phone. And then a couple of years back, I was on holidays with my family and I put my phone in a bag and a Calippo melted in the bag all over my phone. And there is nothing in the world that destroys a phone like a Calippo, right? There's none of this.
An important bit of research you did there, Connor.
Like a salt or whatever it might be. So then I thought, you know, it was the first day of the holiday and I said, this is going to be a great experience. I'm not going to have a phone and I'm going to really enjoy it. I'm on holidays. Nobody needs me. It'll be grand. 3 days later, I had to go into a phone shop in Portugal and buy a phone. I was so distressed at not having it. But not, it wasn't just me. It was the fact that I couldn't access my banking without my phone. I couldn't access anything without my phone. So everything was, I was utterly reliant on this poxy little device in my hand. And it was at that point that I just realised, you know what, just give in. You've lost. Tech has won and it's all over. And I'm sorry, John, if that's what makes me the pessimist.
No.
Very defeatist. Very defeatist.
We might be bad people to ask because we're journalists and it's a tool now. I don't see it as a bad thing. It's a tool that we can't live without in many ways, and everything is on it, like, you know, not only podcasting and social media and the news. Recording devices are now our phones, and I was smiling to myself there when Connor was talking about sharks and viewing them. I was up in Belfast last week at an event with Gerry Adams, where he very kindly sang a well-known Republican anthem known as The Man from the Daily Mail. And to my absolute chagrin, something had gone wrong with my recording. I didn't get it on tape. So journalists use phones in a multifaceted way. So probably not a good people to ask.
Yeah,
whether
that is the nightmare
details,
in media, isn't it? That the device doesn't record.
Yeah,
I do know.
Really, a shout out to anyone who might have been at it up in St. Mary's University College. They may have recorded it too, but it's they're extremely useful devices to us. So maybe we're bad people to ask them. Is a digital detox possible? Because it certainly isn't for me. Because my wages
a cleanse
wouldn't be coming
might
in.
Be good. Like, if you could at least just cleanse some of your social media of some of the negative stuff. Like we were talking earlier and said, it can be a really positive place, but you have to have the willpower to make it a positive place.
Well, you've got to curate it yourself.
Yeah.
And I guess wrestle the algorithm to
yes.
your
so you have to constantly be muting and blocking. And I do a lot of that. I mean, I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. So a lot of the stuff, if I get it and I find it quite triggering, if it's health related. Mm. So I, over the years, have had to become very strong at going block, 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 mute. Not your problem, my problem. I need you gone. But it's really hard to do that.
Yeah.
So it can be a cleanse might be good if we can't detox, because I'm similar to you guys. I use it for work. But
Yeah. Well, speaking of work and those kinds of disasters you can have where you get the interview and you look down and you realise, oh, my God, I haven't hit record. A colleague of mine who shall remain nameless did that very thing with Coldplay, with Chris Martin from Coldplay, and finished this wonderful interview, this exclusive interview, and then looked down and hadn't hit record. And they went, I didn't hit record. And Chris Martin went, it's okay, we'll do it again.
That's lovely. Why everyone loves
Chris
Martin.
A class act.
Jerry Adams is in that league. We're doing the man from the Daily Mail that favour again.
Our Sunday panel will be staying with me, John Lee, Executive Editor, Daily Mail Group, Sheila Nocton, News Talk reporter, Conor Pope, Consumer Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Times. So we're going to go to the north now, because there was a massive anti-racism protest at Belfast City Hall yesterday with thousands out on the street. And on the line, we have Amanda Ferguson, who's a journalist based up in Belfast. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning.
So tell us what was happening. I know there were some protests in Derry, but I believe they weren't actually related to the immigration protests that we've been seeing.
Yes, that's right. There was no protest in Derry. It was street disorder in the Naylor's Row area, where fireworks and petrol bombs and other missiles were used to attack police. Police have said that their public order dog unit was deployed in an attempt to try and de-escalate that. We had heard some police earlier in the evening asking people, to parents and guardians, to come to the area and bring their children home. So there's lots of questions being raised about what actually went on, because some of the footage that has emerged on social media shows that some of the children were extremely young. The Derry City and Strabane Superintendent William Calderwood said that the scene witnessed were disgusting and that he wanted to commend his officers for their professionalism. He said there were difficult conditions for officers across numerous departments. And to date, one arrest has been made, but police are reassuring people that a robust investigation is underway to bring everyone responsible for the violence to justice. So that was a separate contained incident that was happening up in Derry, which was followed, you know, during the day on Saturday. As you mentioned, there was this huge anti-racism rally in Belfast City Centre. I was there, and there was no counter protest from the so-called anti-immigration protesters. And it was notable that there were more people from a black and minority ethnic and Muslim background who were prepared to come into the city centre for the demo, because I think that maybe the demo the night before on Friday night had perhaps given people some confidence.
Tell us about the Muslim Mothers Collective. I know you've been tweeting about that, and they've been keen to make their voices heard.
Yes, I posted that on my Twitter account last night. A group of around 400 Muslim women from across Northern Ireland have a collective organisation called the Muslim Mothers Collective. They have written to the Minister for Education, the DUP, Paul Given MLA. They've also written to the Northern Ireland Council for Integrated Education, the Council for the Catholic Maintained Schools, the Education Authority, the Permanent Secretary of the Education Department at Stormont, and also the Irish Language spokesperson too, really just to find out what is going to be put in place in schools in September to ensure the safety of their children, because they're concerned of the damage from the fallout of what's happened over the last week, and they really just want reassurances that their children are going to be okay.
Mm. There's an interesting story in that the Orange Order's Reverend Mervyn Gibson met with the Muslim Council of Britain in recent days and launched a campaign entitled "Loyalist or Racist, You Can't Be Both." And I guess the anti-racism slant of this story, I guess, is a side of unionism that isn't publicised a huge amount, and I guess pushes against a very different narrative.
Well, I think that what we saw this week is that a number of political representatives and also Mervyn Gibson, who's a senior Orange Order figure, have met with the Muslim Council of Britain to discuss the rioting that's taken place across Belfast. Now, I'm not sure that the Orange Order has issued any official statement of its own, and I'm not sure. I don't think that Mervyn Gibson has posted on social media himself. However, there was a photograph of him holding a poster, "Loyalist or Racist, You Can't Be Both," tackling racism head on, which is publicity material from a previous campaign in sport. So it was to deal with racism in sport and to send that message to loyalists that you don't get to be loyalist or racist. So I think that perhaps people will expect the Orange Order to step up and have a more tailored response because of the influence that it has in the loyalist community. But I think, you know, it's something that should be made clear that the actions of the people that are rioting and intent on race hate and violence and criminal activity aren't representative of all Protestants or unionists or loyalists. And indeed, I've carried statements from the Her Loyal Voice, Loyalist Feminist Women's Group, talking about their disgust at what they've seen, and also that their disappointment at some of sort of lackluster political reaction there has been from some elements within the broad sort of spectrum of unionism and loyalism. But I think that, you know, when you're talking to whether it be businesses in the city centre who are noticing a drop in trade because people are fearful of coming into town, or those businesses that were directly targeted that are owned by Muslims, the whole episode has been really depressing and really damaging to community relations. However, the big message coming from people is that the majority of people are expressing solidarity with people who are different from them, and really just sending that message that the activities, whether they happen in Belfast or Dundalk or Dublin or London or Glasgow or anywhere, that it's not representative of the entire community.
Mm. Thanks so much, Amanda Ferguson, freelance journalist in Belfast. Thanks for chatting to us this morning. We just about have time to talk about some parakeets that are causing havoc in parts of Dublin. They're an invasive species, and in the Sunday Independent today, they mentioned Brian Burke, a wildlife expert and conservation scientist at Birdwatch Ireland, is calling for the community of parakeets to be captured and returned to captivity before the population gets out of control. I know you're very concerned about this, Connor.
I really am, and I didn't know anything about it until about 20 minutes ago, but now I'm quite the expert. So apparently what happened is there was a lot of people in the UK buying pet parakeets in the 1970s, and then they were just too much hassle for them, so they released them into the wild. So the parakeets did what parakeets do, and they all hooked up. And then there was a huge community of parakeets in the UK. And then the first one was spotted in Belfast in 2012. And then there was one spotted in Dublin a couple of years back. And now they're all over North County Dublin. Well, I say all over. Like, there might be a few mating birds, mating pairs.
Yeah, but they are quite invasive, and they have been described as bullies. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's terrible. Then I was thinking, but hang on, maybe finally we've got a contender to take on the bloody seagulls. And, you know, the parakeets, I'm all for them. If they can stop them robbing my chips, they're welcome.
But they might actually rob your chips as well. I don't know what parakeets eat. And then you'd have the parakeets and the seagulls joining forces to take your food. And sure, then where would we be?
Birds. A lot of our species that we are very familiar with are actually invasive, like magpies. And there have been initiatives to get rid of them. And I think I'm from North County Dublin, live there as well. And seagulls are a huge problem, a wild animal that has come into our cities and towns. And there needs to be proper action against them. They're dangerous.
Can we wave at them like you wave at magpies? I mean, we start waving and be like, no, go away.
There's no look around seagulls at all, I think. They bring in birds of prey to deal with them.
I've never guarded sausages as carefully as I did last night. We were brave enough to cook out in the garden, and I looked up and my entire roof of the house was lined with these big giant seagulls just coveting my sausages from up on the rooftop.
You need a dog. That's what you need, because I've got a tiny little Jack Russell.
But he's not able to leap up to the second floor.
I take my dog out to Hoth and we have our fish and chips and whatever, and the seagulls are circling and they clearly want to eat our food, but they're afraid of the dog. Whereas all of the other poor people around us, like, they're having their food demolished by these birds. And we're like,
there's a Marconi
sucks
house
to be
story
you.
That I was told, where a seagull had recently broke into the kitchen upstairs and was found going through a loaf of bread. So there you go.
Really?
They're
should have brought him down and put a pair of headphones on him. Maybe he could have read the news or something. Put him to work.
That's the way it's going.
Thank you so much to my panel, John Lee, Executive Director of the Daily Mail Group, Sheila Nocton, News Talk reporter, and Conor Pope, Consumer Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Times.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.